You are Locked On Rockets, your daily Houston Rockets podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Welcome in to another new episode and a new week of Locked On Rockets, your home for daily podcast commentary on all things Houston Rockets basketball. As always, I'm your host, Ben Dubose, Rockets correspondent with Sports Talk 790, the team's official radio flagship in Houston. As we chat this Monday, the All-Star game, it's officially come and gone. James Harden's team did win the game, and he did have 12 points, including a dagger step-back three over Steph Curry in the final minute to help close it out. And, yeah, it's always fun to see Harden do that to Curry, I'm not going to lie. But look, at the end of the day, it's just an exhibition game, and both Harden and the Rockets, they've got much, much bigger fish to fry this week when the games get started for real again on Thursday against LeBron James and the LA Lakers, a nationally televised game at Staples Center on TNT. So now, with Houston smack dab in the middle of this 8-day off stretch, I'm going to follow through on a promise I made late last week to get a little bit of bigger picture Rockets talk. Because once Thursday and Saturday get here with these big showdowns against the Lakers, the Warriors, I'm sure we're going to get pretty deep into the micro level nitty-gritty of what it is causing the Rockets to win or lose those marquee statement games. For now, to help me examine some of the more macro factors, such as why the Rockets are 33-24 and only in the number 5 spot in the West through 57 games, and whether they'll be able to make a move up the standings once everyone is hopefully healthy, with Clint Capela expected back, still not confirmed. We'll see how he goes through practice this week, but we do expect him back on this other side of the All-Star break beginning Thursday for now. To help break down those factors, I'm going to be joined momentarily by a new guest. His name is Brian Ohringer, and he operates his own YouTube channel and does some writing analysis for a couple of websites. The majority of it is in-depth film study from a scout's perspective on many of the top storylines around the NBA. And Brian does this because he himself was a scout. More on that momentarily. As far as the Rockets go, he actually had a great film study on YouTube a couple of weeks back breaking down James Harden's 61-point game at Madison Square Garden. And the simplest way you can find that and the rest of his work is probably by going to his own website, which you can find at scoutwithbrian.com. That's Brian with the letter Y. Anyway, though, the reason Brian is such a good resource to fans is because he spent the majority of the past decade working within the league itself. From 2013 through 2017, he was the head video coordinator with the Washington Wizards, and then from 2017 through 2018, he was a regional advanced scout with both the Atlanta Hawks and the Toronto Raptors. So he certainly brings a unique perspective, both as someone that interacts on social media with the NBA fan masses, but also as someone that has worked with multiple NBA teams as they game plan to stop players and teams like James Harden and the Rockets. So to get that scout-level perspective on Harden, Chris Paul, Clint Capela, and, well, everything else going on with the 2019 Houston Rockets, let's go straight to the phone lines and get Brian Ohringer connected right here at Locked On Rockets. Brian, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Glad to finally connect with you after following your work for a while on Twitter. And I want to start, before we go into the Rockets specifically, letting our audience know a little bit more about your background, because clearly you've worked for the better part of a decade in the NBA, the Wizards, the Hawks, the Raptors. Now you're transitioning more into my world a little bit of media analysis, but just discuss what you're trying to do, because it's somewhat of a unique role, I think, in that you're taking some skills that are normally behind closed doors, the scouting arena, and then trying to now apply them on the more media and fan side of the fence.
Yeah, so like you said, I spent 4 years full-time as the head video coordinator with the Wizards and then did regional scouting for the Hawks and Raptors last year. So, you know, in my time in the NBA, kind of learned and realized I didn't want to be attached to that lifestyle where the head coach is fired every couple of years and you have to move around the country nonstop. So, had the idea to give media a try, you know, seeing what guys like, Amin El-Hassan was a video coordinator. Mm-hmm. And I've been on ESPN for a long time, or, you know, Sebastian Parisi used to do the X's and O's stuff on Twitter, and now works for a team. So my idea was kind of, what if you could do that in reverse? What if you could go from, you know, the team side to really understanding the terminology and X's and O's and, you know, provide that to the public. So that's kind of what I've tried to do on Twitter and YouTube with some of my film and articles and all that good stuff.
Of course, you cover the league as a whole, but I've been drawn to a couple of the things that you've done with the Rockets and James Harden in particular. You did a YouTube breakdown from Harden's perspective of the 61 he put up in Madison Square Garden, which is still his career high. And as someone that's dealt the last 5+ years with actual NBA teams, front offices, players, that kind of dynamic, and now deals with some of the narratives that you see on Twitter, where is the split widest on Harden? Because it's just staggering when you talk to people around the league, you know, myself in my media capacity, just dealing with coaches and players, what they say about the guy. And of course, we know what the data says, you know, for all the talk on Twitter about, oh, it takes him X amount of shots to put up these points. Well, actually, he grades out as one of the more efficient, unselfish scorers of our era. But just generally speaking, it looks like there's just a huge split between some of the narratives and then between from that to what folks actually in the game think. So what are the reasons for that? What are the things you encounter about Harden in particular that are so difficult to get past the fans and the narrative?
Yeah, I mean, I think any time you really reach a certain level of success, you know, obviously the haters kind of come out of the woodwork and have to try to invent things, holes in your game that aren't even really there. You know, I think for Harden in particular, like you said, I mean, he was a few years ago, he's the model of the analytics community, this guy that's modeled his game after efficiency, threes and rim and free throws, and now you've got people somehow espousing that he's not efficient, even though, you know, like you said, he is still doing it on a very efficient, you know, number of possessions and shots. And yeah, I mean, I just generally think a lot of the stuff about him is just unfounded and unfair. You know, you've got people calling him a ball hog when, in my opinion, he's one of, if not the best passer, you know, in the NBA right now, one of the best pick and roll players. I think he just always makes the right read and cares about winning and makes the right play for his team. And, you know, you've seen coaches throughout the year say the same thing. And I think that's a pretty universal opinion, you know, in the actual NBA. I think it's just some of the talking heads love to try to stir the pot a little bit and invent some things that aren't really there.
What is it that makes him so difficult to defend relative to even other great scorers? I know you've discussed this some on your videos, but what is it about James in particular that is so unique compared to, you know, even some of the other top 10 players today in terms of developing a game plan for?
I think easy answer, you know, is obviously the step back is lethal, and I've likened it to like being this generation's Jordan fadeaway in the post. You know, I think no matter how well you defend him, that move is just pretty much unguardable, and best thing you can do is just hope to contest him without fouling it. But beyond that, I mean, I think the credit to James and what people don't, you know, sometimes appreciate fully is that his game is all based on fundamentals, and being able to get to the free throw line as often as he does, you know, people point to a couple of the times he's fouled on threes that occasionally are questionable, but he also leads the league in drives per game. You know, he attacks the basket relentlessly, and that's based on having a phenomenal handle, being able to get by his man at will, you know, not turning the ball over, you know, his shot's obviously pretty much perfected. I mean, every element of skill, ball handling, passing, shooting, you know, he pretty much just has perfected in his game, and that's, you know, that's what makes him just a nightmare for coaches to game plan against. And there's some things I think that have slightly more effective, like forcing him right, but even then, you know, you're pretty much just crossing your fingers and hoping he doesn't go for 40 that night.
How do you grade him out defensively? Because to me, he's tough to evaluate in that he's certainly not a good on-ball perimeter defender. Some of the advanced metrics don't lie, but at the same time, he does seem to make a lot of heads-up plays, certainly away from the ball. He leads the league or is close to it in deflections. He's in like the 90th-something percentile in post defense, which is useful in a scheme that switches as much as the Rockets do. I think we're past the point that it was 5 years ago. I think most people realize that he's not just a complete joke defensively, but also the Rockets are kind of in a point where they have to use him in the right situations. Is that how you see it? I'm just kind of curious how you grade him out on that end, because he feels like kind of a unique player in that at times he can be really good, and then there are other times in which, you know, you see why he's never going to be a particularly good defensive player because the tools just aren't there.
Yeah, I think he. I think first and foremost, you know, the same tremendous IQ he has offensively, I think that helps him a lot on the defensive end. You know, in terms of deflections, anticipating, you know, really knowing what's going on. I think he's perfectly capable of being a really good defender when he needs to be. I think just the general issue is kind of more of a usage issue. How much they're asking him to do right. offensively, I think, just requires, you know, having to hide him a little bit defensively and ask him to do a little bit less on that end, just because of the wear and tear and how much he has to carry them on the other side. But I agree with you. I think he's a underrated defender overall. I think he's really improved in terms of picking up some of like the technique from Chris Paul in terms of guarding the post. I think he's, you know, his hands and, like you mentioned, the deflections obviously have been a real plus. And I think he's proved that he's not a liability on that end. I think nobody would consider him elite there either. But I think he fits in fine. And, you know, the question is just going to be how much can he ramp up the effort, you know, when the playoffs are really going to demand that he does both on both ends every night.
I want to transition our talk to a guy you just mentioned, Chris Paul, because I think what we all can agree is that certainly efficiency-wise, his numbers this year are not what they were a year ago. What I'm curious to hear your take on is why. Because when I discuss this with Twitter, everyone is hypersensitive. Chris Paul, he's 33 years old. He's in year 14. He got the big contract. And any time there's even one possession where he can't shake, say, a big on a switch, you have this segment that's just waiting to say, oh, Chris Paul is washed. And my response to that, I'm not going to say there's no aging component to it, but I feel like a lot of the folks that make these arguments are comparing current Chris Paul to a guy that they saw, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago, as opposed to the guy that led the entire league in real plus minus a year ago. And Brian, my opinion is that it's important to compare 2019 Chris Paul to 2018 Chris Paul, because obviously the older version is not going to come back. But with Chris, a year ago, he was still really good, even with that, what I would call old man at the Y game. It's not like he just blew by people off the dribble with regularity. There's just a certain savvy, a way that he's able to position himself and, of course, pick his spots to where even with reduced athleticism, between his IQ, his understanding, his teammates in Houston spacing the floor, obviously James Harden, it works. And this year, he's been better since coming back from the hamstring, not quite to where he was a year ago. But I'm just curious your perspective on this dynamic, because when I see Chris Paul, I'm certainly not saying that everything is fine, but for some of the takes we see on Twitter, I'm wondering if some of these people haven't watched Chris Paul in the last 5 years. Because last year's Chris Paul, it's not like he was ultra springy. It's not like he was blowing by people. It's just for various reasons, it worked a little bit better than it has this year. So as you see it, what's the difference in 2019 Chris Paul versus 2018?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, like you said, I think some of the questions about his age and the contract obviously are fair and are things that, you know, kind of come with just an aging player who's, you know, more injury prone at this point and has lost a little bit of a step. But at the same point, you know, kind of what you're saying also, I think his game never was really based on, you know, being the most athletic or the guy that jumps out of the gym. His game's always been based on, you know, craft and ball handling and, you know, passing and being able to shoot and all those things. I think he can still do and still do at a really high level. You know, I think, like you said, you got to continue to give him some time coming back from injury and working himself back into elite shape. And obviously you have to get Capella and the full supporting cast back around him so that, you know, he can really play the role he's supposed to play. But, yeah, I mean, if I was Houston, I wouldn't be losing too much sleep about Chris Paul. I think his game, like you said, is based on bet savvy and his brilliance for the game. And I would trust those things will definitely come back, you know, come playoff time at worst, if not in the, you know, in the near future.
How do players, in your eyes, generally age? I've had this conversation with David Locke before, who, of course, the radio voice of the Utah Jazz, the godfather of this network. And one of the interesting things, I know it varies a lot from player to player. I'm just curious your perspective, having been around the league. Does it generally happen very quickly? Is it a slow erosion? Just if you could shed light, not just on Chris Paul in particular, but just the league as a whole, what are the signs that you look for? What are the things that players can do to perhaps counteract that? Because I just feel like, you know, it's a catch-all on Twitter that whenever a player in his early 30s has any sort of decline, it must be the age. And of course, some of it is just randomness. So I guess from your perspective, how do you distinguish between what's just randomness, Chris Paul missing some shots that he made a year ago, versus what's a player that's actually, you know, lost something off his fastball?
Yeah, it's really a kind of a million-dollar question. I don't know if there's a good answer or a way you can always know. I think it's very much on a case-by-case basis. And, you know, obviously you've got guys like LeBron that people will point to that'll probably be good until he's about 60. But, you know, personal experience, I remember being around Paul Pierce in D.C., and actually this might kind of be a decent Chris Paul type example, because with about 2 weeks or so left in the regular season, I remember we basically just shut Paul down for like a 10-day period because he almost just looked like he was just done. I mean, he could not move. He could not guard anybody. He could not make a shot. I mean, the coaches were literally like questioning if he would, you know, be able to play in another game. And, you know, they gave him a couple weeks off, brought him back for a tiny little tune-up before the playoffs, and then that's the year, obviously, he went on to beat Toronto with that I called game bank shot, and just was unbelievable in that series against them. You know, and his career did kind of turn down a little bit sooner, I think, than some people expected, and he's kind of an example of a guy aging pretty quickly. But, it's a tough thing to really sense. I think sometimes in the player's mind, just when they know, they kind of feel it when they just lost a step or don't feel like they can do the things they did before. But at the same time, you see a lot of older players in the league now, you know, being able to transition to more off-ball roles and still have a lot of success. So I personally would think Chris Paul is more in that group. As long as Harden can continue to, you know, do most of the ball handling, I think Chris will be just fine, you know, playing mostly off the ball and also handling a little bit. But, I think each guy is unique, and depending on the injury or depending on what kind of slows them down, I think some guys do hit the wall sooner than others, and I'm not exactly sure why that is.
Transitioning to the Rockets as a whole, beyond just Harden and CP3, they're 33-24, not the record fifth in the West that a lot of fans expected, but obviously injuries have had a lot to do with it. Everything about the Rockets, clearly they kind of fall back on that Harden, Paul, and Capella foundation. Everybody remembers the ridiculous record they had a year ago when all three of those guys played. This year, they've only played, I think, close to 20 games together. Most of those at the beginning of the year when they had the Carmelo situation hanging over them, the conference finals hangover. Even Harden got injured, so there were a lot of extenuating circumstances to that. And assuming Capella checks out this week, they'll have him back for the other side of the All-Star break. We're getting Thursday night in L.A. So it's kind of a weird dynamic. They're fifth in the West, but Vegas ranks them as clearly second behind the Warriors, well ahead. I looked at the odds today, than even Denver and Oklahoma City. So as I see it, that feels reasonable to you, even though the record isn't there. Does that feel about right that at this point the Warriors are certainly big favorites, but are the Rockets still their biggest threat? Just curious how you see this team, assuming they're finally able to put some games together healthy.
Yeah, I think that sounds about right. I mean, I think, in the playoffs, as much as we'd love to believe in the teams, like Atlanta a few years ago that have a lot of balance and have, you know, four really good players or whatever, kind of like a Denver, this year, I think ultimately in the playoffs, the team with the superstars tends to win out. And I think that's why, you know, you see Houston still have the belief that they do from Vegas, from the analytics community. I think obviously Oak City's right there too, especially in having, towards having the season he's having and having Russ, who, you know, despite shooting so poorly, is obviously a tenacious competitor who can really turn it on and win games when he needs to. But, I think Houston's still in a great place. I think, Shumpert will be a really good pickup for them. And I think if Morey can, you know, maybe get House back up there and a couple other little trimmings that they can adjust and make sure they have enough shooting and so on, I think they have, you know, as good of a chance as anybody really to compete with Golden State.
What do you see as their biggest need? You mentioned House. There's other buyout targets they could go after. One of the things that's difficult to analyze, for a lot of fans, they've seen this team look really small the past couple of weeks with Kenneth Faried at the center spot. But, of course, it goes back to the fact that Capella has been out. So even though I feel like that there's a segment of the community that's focused on the five, to me, long-term, it's Daniel House as a three slash occasionally small ball four with Mike D'Antoni that's actually the bigger need for what they want to do, assuming that that Capella's healthy. How do you see it? You know, Daryl Morey, they've got a portion in the mid-level exception. They've got House's rights, just about whether to give him a 1, 2, or 3-year deal. What's their biggest need as it comes to fortifying this roster, the end of the bench, the rotation spots, as they get ready for April and May?
Yeah, I think the four is definitely kind of an area of need. You know, you got to find somebody, you know, alongside PJ who can at least give you some valuable 10-15 minutes in a playoff game. You know, that could be House. I mean, he's got some size and is able to play switching defense and shoot relatively well, but, you know, he also doesn't have the experience. I don't know if they fully trust him like that in a playoff game. You know, Faried, like you mentioned, obviously an undersized five. He can play some four, I guess, just in terms of, you know, energy and just, again, being a roller hustle guy, but obviously isn't going to space the floor and do the things you guys normally ask of your foreman. So yeah, I think that's, you know, potentially a need. And then beyond that, I think, you know, just if they can somehow find another wing that could make shots, you know, just as insurance again, if Gordon or Paul or whoever get banged up a bit, I think they, you know, did a good job getting Shumpert, like I said. But I think Ariza's obviously been a big loss kind of through the season. I think Ennis obviously was a poor man's attempt kind of to replicate him. But, you know, you see, even though Ariza, you know, I know he slowed down a lot this year, maybe they made the right choice, but him being able to shoot off screens occasionally, him being able to shoot at the volume he did, was kind of just like a perfect fit for the way Houston wants to play. And I'm not sure they've really found anybody that's willing to get it up the way he does. So if by somehow in the bio market or G League or otherwise they could find, you know, somebody that's a shooter off and down or something to give them another weapon, I think that's definitely something they should look into.
Last question for you, as far as the Rockets are concerned, just curious, you've worked with a few organizations. What the perception of the Houston front office, the coaching staff is around the league? Because it's kind of weird. Certainly the Rockets, they're a bit more forward, or at least have been. You know, they were, you think back to 10, 15 years ago, at the forefront of the analytics revolution. Now a lot of teams seem to have adopted that. Just curious what the, you know, the perception is around the league, because, you know, especially from a player's standpoint, of course, some can be resistant to change. But organizationally, it feels like a lot of teams, you know, must somewhat agree with the way that Daryl Morey, Mike D'Antoni, those types of guys see the game, based on the fact that, you know, if anything, one of the, you know, kind of the drawbacks to Houston this season, Matt Buller, the Rockets play-by-play analyst, has talked about this, is that the math advantage, 3 versus 2 a year ago, that's been so pronounced, well, that's going more and more away, because you're seeing more teams, certainly the Nets, but there's a lot of others that try to adopt Houston's principles. So as a guy that's worked, you know, game planning with organizations, how is Houston perceived? Because it feels like that, you know, they must be doing something right if so many other teams are adopting these same principles and these same strategies organizationally.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of a mixed bag. I think, you know, I think one thing that really helps them is having D'Antoni. I think he's kind of universally respected for the most part among players, and especially offensive-minded guys, you know, because he's just viewed, the guys I've talked to in the league and players that have played for him, as a guy that just gives everybody confidence, that he just wants guys to take every open shot, that he has tremendous trust and belief in guys and puts them in great positions and just lets them play offensively. And, you know, I think that's even more so than Morey, who's been doing this kind of system and analytics, obviously, for a long time in Houston. I think pairing it with with the coach, you know, who's the perfect, you know, kind of inventor of the spread pick and roll and just perfect stylistic fit, has been a match made in heaven. But as far as the overall picture, I mean, I think some people, you know, some people like it, and there's analytics guys, obviously, that have GM jobs and kind of subscribe to that, but there's also still the old guard a little that's sure. a little skeptical of Maury or don't like the way he courts media attention or interacts with fans or whatever sometimes. But, you know, I think overall they respect what the job he's done over a long period of time, and that obviously there's something to it, and it's definitely influenced the way a lot of the league has played. But the same thing like Harden, you know, when you have success, you're going to have haters too, and Maury and D'Antoni and Houston as a whole are not immune to that either.
I think you hit the nail on the head with the importance of D'Antoni on that, because it's important, even if, you know, they're in alignment, and in many ways because they're in alignment, to have a guy who's a little bit more of a front man, seen a bit more favorably. You know, I think back to after J.B. Bickerstaff was let go, the period in which they could have gone after, say, a Jeff Van Gundy or a more defensive-oriented coach, which a lot of people around the league expected them to do, and folks were confused why they went the direction they did. Well, what ended up happening ultimately, you know, now you have Maury and D'Antoni, and there's all these synergies, they're in alignment, but in many ways it puts Maury in a better position to actually implement his beliefs, because there's a guy who he's in, you know, full lockstep with. And then as far as getting players to buy in, then yeah, it's a lot easier to get the buy-in as far as the players into what the organization is trying to do if there's a head coach that's embracing it. And so even though there were some that wondered, hey, you know, for an offensive team, does bringing in an offensive coach make that much sense? But when you talk about the overall, the kind of linear perspective of it, I think that's why they went where they did. And ultimately, it's worked out pretty well to this point. Brian, thank you so much for the time. Before we let you go, folks, this is Brian Orringer, NBA scout, formerly with the Wizards, the Hawks, the Raptors, among others, was the video coordinator with Washington. Tell people where they can find your work now, because I know you've got your YouTube channel, you've got Twitter, you've got your website, and you write for a few publications. Just toss out whatever plugs as far as where Rockets fans can find some of your work.
Sure. So, yeah, best places on Twitter, as you mentioned, just at Scout with Brian with a Y. I've got scoutwithbrian.com also. That's kind of just an archive of everything I've done or videos I've put out so far, where they can find the Harden video in peace. And all that should be pretty easy to find on the Twitter and the website. So.
Sounds good. Well, Brian, thanks so much for the time, and look forward to talking with you again.
Thank you for having me. Really enjoyed it.
Good stuff there with Brian Orringer, former scout with the Washington Wizards, Toronto Raptors, Atlanta Hawks. Always enjoy being able to pick people's brains, not just outside the game, but inside it on occasion as well. So we thank him for taking the time. Hopefully you guys learned something, and perhaps we can have him back down the road. For now, though, this is where we'll wrap up Monday's show. If you want more content before our next episode, the best place to get it is on Twitter. As Brian mentioned, he's on there at Scout with Brian. I'm on there at Ben Dubose. The show is on there at Locked On Rockets. Also, we've got a Locked On NBA Net handle on both Twitter and Instagram, where you can find curated feed experts from across the Locked On Podcast Network covering all of their teams, just like I do here in Houston. Also, if you'd be kind enough to subscribe to this podcast to find out future episodes, the best place to get it, well, it's anywhere. iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Megaphone, Spotify, because we're part of a great network of shows. The distribution is virtually unlimited, just at your podcast platform provider of choice. Subscribe, leave 5-star reviews, even if you can't advertise yourself, which I would love for you to do, by the way. Got some great introductory specials, lockedonrockets@gmail.com. Hint, hint, but even if you can't do that, subscribe, leave 5-star reviews, and that's how we can look attractive to potential advertisers and keep the business model rolling here at Locked On Rockets as the most regular podcast covering Houston Rockets basketball. So for today, on this Monday, February 18th, this is where we'll break. As always, thanks for listening, and please come back soon for more episodes right here at Locked On Rockets, your home for daily coverage of Houston Rockets basketball.